Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I'm Dan Safarik.
And I'm Greg Lindsay, and welcome to episode 95, Cities for Forests. This is a special Montreal episode because Dan was just here in town for my birthday. Yes, it was my birthday recently. We had a lovely little party with my girlfriend, Michelle Champagne, and several of her colleagues from Chevalier Morales, the architecture firm. We had the architectural photographer, James Britton. But the most fun guest we had, who I hadn't seen in several years, is Cities for Forests' Scott Francisco. Scott is Canadian, emigrated back to Canada shortly before I moved here in 2019, and we just lost touch during the pandemic, and there he was at the party. And so the three of us had a great time to chat and catch up with him about his work. And so for you listeners who are not available to join me for my birthday party, this is our episode here to cue you back in on what you missed in that particular setting. But before we get to Scott, very shortly, Dan, you were here on a mission in Montreal. It's been 3 years since you were last here. Keen listeners will know, I think it was episode, I don't think we even have a number, but it was April 2022. But Dan, what was your semi-secret mission for the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitats here?
Well, it's no secret, Greg. I was here to speed run the REZO network, which is a Francophone acronym for the Underground Pedestrian network system that is that underlies a good portion of downtown Montreal. As it turns out, it is about 11 miles long if you try to do it one way. According to my step tracker, it's 23,700 something steps and 11 miles ish. It was a system that was conceived in the late 60s as an extension of the Place Ville-Marie, the famous IMP building at the center of town, the cruciform study in modernism, and it just expanded from there because it typically is rather cold in this city, and people want to be able to carry on their lives. And so it is now one of a series of about a dozen networks that my organization is studying, and I'm co-writing a book with James Parekh, who's a city planner in Toronto. Bitter rival, by the way, not only in hockey and everything else with Montreal, but as it turns out, in underground networks. Studying the effect of these on the street, looking at how well executed they are in terms of, you know, retail presence, security, safety, how coherent they are in terms of design. Do you always know that you're in the network or don't you? Can you find them from the outside, from the street? And then, you know, some of them sort of break the rules a little bit, and they're not all underground, and some of them run on the ground, some of them connect buildings as sky bridges. So we're looking at cities as diverse as Hong Kong, Kuala Lumpur, Calgary, Chicago, Houston, Minneapolis, Montreal, and of course, Toronto. So that's the essence of it. It will be the output, the work product is going to be a technical guide under the CTBUH Urban Habitats series, and we'll be discussing it in Toronto in early October if you'd like to stop by at our international conference.
I hope to be there. I just love, again, Canada. Tunnels and malls. It happens in very cold and very hot climates, hence like why there's so many good Canadians working on golf projects there, because it's a bit more of the same. All right, well, listeners, we invite you to join us in Toronto for that presentation. But I want to bring out Scott here, because as I mentioned, Scott basically runs Cities for Forests, which I'll read briefly the boilerplate, a global alliance of cities acting to conserve, restore, and sustainably manage nature, especially the world's forests, for human well-being. And if you immediately default to, like, you know, your urbanist bias here to think this is about, you know, cities regreening themselves or protect their own forests, no, Scott is actually out there mobilizing cities to protect forests out in nature in the rainforest and has a fascinating global alliance. But anyway, without further ado, Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be here, and thanks for having me to your party for champagne and champagne. And you know, it was fun to reconnect with both of you. And Dan and I go back to an important event in 2015 where we launched a community of practice called Wood at Work, and Dan brought the Council for Tall Buildings perspective on tall timber buildings as one of the many great speakers at that event when this conversation about the use of timber in cities as a building material is actually quite new. I'm here based in Montreal. Our agency here is called Pilot Projects Collaborative. We are a co-founder of the Cities for Forests Network that you've mentioned, Greg, and I'm one of the directors. It's shared with the World Resources Institute. So there's two co-founding organizations, my company, Pilot Projects Collaborative, and the World Resources Institute. The mission of that, again, is just to harness the energy and ambitions of cities in their sustainability, views and activities and programs, and for the well-being of the residents, and see if that can be directed towards the health of the world's forests. And we think of forests in that context in three ways: the inner forest, the nearby forest, and the faraway forest. So from the eyes of a city, of course, you have the forests, and in Montreal, we're blessed with some incredible inner forests. Our family makes use of them pretty much every single day. Our little kids are on the mountain, which is a beautiful homestead design, natural park with an incredible sort of micro forest on the world scale, but for the city, it's a wonderfully large and mysterious forest for kids with all kinds of activities. So that's the inner forest. The nearby forest would be the forests within, we often say, within a couple hundred kilometers of a city, which are therefore, that can be accessed by the residents of the city, but very importantly are often part of a watershed system protecting the sort of the natural, the local natural ecosystem, and often utilities for the city. Climate mitigation, which inner forests also do for the city, mitigating heat island effect and pollinators, and there's a whole wealth of benefits that those nearby forests bring, as well as economics, job opportunities, and again, recreation, very important. We're big cross-country skiers, for example, which is one of 1,000 uses of these nearby forests. We're out there all the time, winter and summer. And then the faraway forest, which is really where Pilot Project's heart is at when it comes to cities and the urban, basically the zeitgeist of urban leadership in the world today, is how can cities become more aware and more active and capable of having an impact on these absolutely vital ecosystems for the planet. And the tropical forests of the world are, most people hear about it regularly, and some listeners, I'm sure, are actively involved in this, but we basically can't survive on this planet without those forests. They provide an enormous number of global scale or ecosystem services, and by way of water mitigation or water systems, both the rivers, the rainfall. Much of the world's agriculture depends on the rainfall that is actually controlled by tropical forests globally. Of course, all of the biodiversity that we're just scratching the surface of really understanding. So our position on this is that with the leadership, the enthusiasm, awareness that cities are showing on global environmental issues, it's time for cities to be to get excited about these forests that may be thousands of kilometers away from them, but are nonetheless absolutely essential for their well-being. So that's a maybe a slightly longer version of the why of Cities for Forests. Well, let me do this. Let's use Montreal as a bit of a jumping off spot, because here we are in, I think we all agree, one of the world's great cities. And I grew up in Toronto, by the way, so
Does Toronto have a mountain? Does your city have a mountain, dear listener? We have a mountain, and our mountain is great. Like, we are the mountain, Mont Royal. Like, you know, that's exactly our whole city. So yes, we have a mountain and a forest.
I did grow up in Toronto, and so I have also a great love for that city, and it's kind of so nice to be kind of caught in the middle of two wonderful cities in the world. And I'll be heading to Toronto tomorrow, actually, for the weekend, before heading to South America. So maybe my upcoming 4 days is indicative. Here I am in Montreal. I'll be stopping in Toronto to visit family for the Easter holiday weekend, and then off to South America for 3 stops, one in Ecuador, one in Brazil, and one in Guyana. And so actually that little microcosm in a way represents the kind of coalition building that we're doing here. But Montreal was one of the founding cities of Cities for Forests. So when we got initially funding for this network, we put out the call to cities throughout all of our respective networks, and we were able to bring 40 cities on board at the very beginning, and those were essentially the founding cities to get this initiative up and running. And to those cities, Montreal being one of them, Toronto being another one of them, we offered to essentially support existing initiatives that they had that were looking at that range of issues. Most cities have an urban trees program, and most leading cities are quite serious about that, and for obvious reasons. It's, in a certain way, you could say, easy to think about the trees that are right in front of your face, right? Whether it's street trees or the local parks. And we think that's absolutely critical for the well-being of residents in the cities, and there's so many studied benefits of those kinds of trees. But when you look at it at the global climate scale, those trees don't really matter very much, to be perfectly honest. They're wonderful for the local environment, and that's, again, essential for the cities to function properly. But when it comes to climate issues and global biodiversity issues and some of the broader global issues, even on equity and climate adaptation, you see that these big forests far outweigh the benefit. So again, it's like, could we get these cities who are doing great things in their cities with trees to say, let's look beyond? What does that actually look like? Well, one issue is procurement. Cities are where the majority of people on the planet live these days, so you've kind of already got a pretty good market base for decision making. So if anything that we buy that cities can buy directly, or that the residents can sort of get behind, becomes an opportunity for positive leverage, whether that's shade grown coffee, for instance. Like, I mean, I'm a huge coffee fan. I don't know how many I drink a day, but we have a wonderful coffee here at our office. Let's just say that I drink 6 cups of coffee a day. If every one of those cups of coffee is part of an economic support for biodiverse shade grown coffee, every time I do that, I'm changing the system. Because coffee is one of those commodities where it's a perfect example, really, of how the way we consume can have either a devastating effect on these ecosystems or a positive effect. And so it's not just neutrality, it can be very bad and it can be very good. On the very bad side, historically, Arabica coffee is about deforesting areas to allow a lot of sun, so often cloud forests were just kind of mown down to grow coffee plants. Now, coffee is actually a shade forest plant, but to sort of increase the efficiency, you basically deforest the area and you grow a monoculture. But what we've always known is that coffee also does very well in forested biodiverse environments. And of course, now you can see on our supermarket shelves, you can see that on the packaging. And so there's really great authentic agroforestry products like coffee, where every time you use it, you help farmers and producers restore and maintain these vital ecosystems. Now, we talked a little bit about wood, so I'll just plant that. I want to come back to that, but you've got your hand up there, Greg. So what's your
I do want to jump in. Well, I mean, a meta question here for you, which I've always wondered about Cities for Forests, which is, I'm curious about how you get this sort of flywheel going, and why it makes sense to have cities in dialogue with their hinterland regions. Because I've always wondered, is there a direct relationship there, and how? And you've obviously built this network, so I'm curious if you could give a couple other examples about the dialogue. Because I've always wondered, is it really a linked problem, or is it we've got this crisis over here of cities and their lack of tree cover and the need for greenery, and we have this crisis of deforestation over here, and maybe we can try to put the two together. But you found logics that actually make sense. And I'm also curious, can you convince mayors to care about hinterland forests? How do you do the political advocacy portion of this? Because I do want to come back to that.
Oh, gosh. It is actually pretty challenging.
Mayor Valerie Plante here in Montreal, how do you, Valerie is a good urbanist. How do you make this pitch to her if you want to keep it local?
Well, I will jump to another upcoming event, which is in Hue, Vietnam. So there's a meeting of the Alliance of Francophone Mayors that's led by the city of Paris. Paris has been, as of recently, one of our really active cities in the network. I will say a challenge of the network, and we're, again, about 100 cities right now, is to keep that flywheel moving, right? To kind of keep momentum, keep enthusiasm, find specific programs and opportunities that are specific enough to the city's, sort of political landscape and the particular mayor's interest, and keep that moving. So that is an ongoing challenge. Broadly speaking, we have an objective for that cities can learn from each other. So programs that one city is willing to pioneer can then be shared by others, and you know, it doesn't have to all be invented from scratch. So just leveraging the city-to-city learning network, which is exists in many forms already. So we're kind of tapping into that. But I think there's another piece which is more challenging, but where I see that's the greater impact, which is that, if we can just be philosophical a little bit for a minute, is that cities stop seeing themselves as entities that are in any way autonomous, right? So in some respects, the climate climate change awareness movement from the city perspective, pioneered really by C40, which was C20 back in the day. It was really started by Ken Livingstone and Nikki Gavron in London, and it grew up from there. Bloomberg kind of took it over and built this great network. So C40 has had an incredible impact on, they're really you could say the poster child for city networks that have taken action and proved out the worth of this kind of dialogue. So we to some degree have hitched ourselves to that model. But there's a downside, I think, to that model, and specifically when it comes to carbon and climate, and that's the net zero cities movement, which of course sounds like a great thing, and in many ways is a great thing. Like, okay, well, wouldn't it be great if cities could be net zero, ... But perhaps we're asking kind of the wrong question there, which is to think of that, to conceive of that assumes there's a boundary, a systems boundary around the city, wherein you can say, you know, this idea that the city is net zero is somehow accomplished within the boundary. And that's manifest in the emissions categories of scope 1, scope 2, and scope 3, which has been an ongoing challenge. And just for I'm sure most of the listeners are aware of this, but scope 1 emissions is direct emissions. Like if I have a furnace in my building, in a city, and whatever comes out of the smokestack, that is scope 1 emissions. It's actually being emitted by the burning of a fossil fuel or something like that inside the city. The scope 2 is grid power that is serving the city, so even if your power plant is outside, you count that as scope 2. And scope 3 is kind of all the stuff that's happening because the city is doing something, and it's like what we have, in order to achieve the net zero model, we've had to mostly exclude the scope 3. It is starting to come back, it is starting to come into the, let's just say, awareness and responsibility framework, but we're quite a long ways away from actually having that really work. And when you think about that problem, you pretty quickly you realize most of the city's impact is actually outside of the boundaries of the city.
Which is so difficult in discourse. I mean, I read about this in particularly in like climate adaptation circles. Like after Hurricane Sandy in New York, for example, you saw a lot of discourse, you know, New York is building the big U by Bjarke Ingels, a lot of discussion about what New York can do, but that scope 3 effects of like migrant inflows from climate disasters elsewhere or other potential systemic effects that does not ever get factored in. And so I'm not surprised it doesn't get factored in here either, but like, yes, modeling this is so painfully difficult. So how do you model in or convince them to do it?
I'm going to get to that in a second, just to track that up just a little further, is to say, just to play this out, you've got all of the materials, all the food, all the people, all the ideas. It's a city is essentially a node in a system of flows, right? So if we change our mindset about a city, and we say the territorial boundary of a city is, it's in many ways an abstraction. Of course, it represents municipal authority, and that's important, right? Like, what can you actually do? What authority do you have as a city? Well, you have authority primarily simply with what's in your territorial boundary, right? You can't execute laws, etc. But the level of influence, the level of flow mitigation and transformation is enormous and way, way, way beyond what's happening inside that switch box, right? The city is a kind of a switch box, but it's the ins and outs of that are very powerful. So if we think of cities that way, we think of like where, how do we tap into the influence that they have? You've got governmental influence, right? Like especially bigger cities, typically their government centers often for national government, either the national government of the country or if not the national government, often a department of major significance. So there's quite a lot of of influence and let's just call that power for cities to have to influence up through government levels. There's the cultural influence, right? Which is like, this is where culture is shaped and formed in many respects. We could say for better or worse, but I mean that's what brings people to cities, is to be part of the shaping of a culture. So if that culture can be, and that ambition can be harnessed, there's a whole other level of influence. So we have a regulatory, global systemic influence potential. We have the global cultural influence. We have the technologies that are being shaped and formed in cities, both for the use in cities, but also for the use globally. So if you've got a tech hub somewhere, or a tech ecosystem, big or small, that is a world influencing opportunity, to say the least. And then there's of course the markets, right? The flows of capital, the kinds of investment that are happening, just the way people think about money and growth and lack of growth. All of these things are happening in cities. So markets, culture, regulations, and technology are all being shaped in cities. These are the macro social systems that shape our world. So how do we actually do something about that? We're trying to, in Cities for Forest, trying to sort of target like node opportunities within cities. So one of our programs is called the Partner Forest Program. And that's basically, let's build something in a city which has a high degree of public exposure that people can look at, touch and feel, and sit on. Whether it's a bench or a boardwalk or a wharf or something like that, this is where we get into the conversation about timber, because this is actually one of the materials that comes from a forest that can have, again, like coffee, either a devastating or a very positive impact on forest conservation. So that program is about connecting cities with a piece of public infrastructure and a forest and just building awareness. So this is where we're kind of getting that cultural impact. It's like, oh, I never thought of wood that way, or I never thought of how tropical wood could be part of a conservation story. So that's a huge part of our work, is we've kind of put it under the umbrella of conservation timber. We know that, generally speaking, bio-based materials have a lot to offer. I don't want to say they're in a panacea, because they don't solve every problem, but the use of a regenerative material like timber, if it is harvested in a positive way where it's forest positive, it really displaces a huge amount of emissions and other kinds of pollutants and negative impacts, and can do something very positive. So bringing wood into cities that is rich with a narrative, that has a transparent connection to the forest and the people in that forest working in all aspects of the value chain, right? Everything from cultivating, conserving, planting, restoring the forest, harvesting, processing, transporting, processing once again, manufacturing products, say for example the mass timber space, we're very involved in that, and that's not tropical wood typically, that's usually from a northern, well, from a softwood source. Montreal is a big leader in that. We have several companies in the Montreal area that are world leaders in producing mass timber products and showing the world what you can do in cities with large chunks of wood. Amazingly, made from relatively small trees. So one of the leaders in Montreal is based in Montreal, is Nordic Structures. Their wood comes from northern Quebec. Lots of interesting partnerships with indigenous landholders there and in the supply of their timber. It's very vertically integrated. But the cool thing is that they're building buildings that are 5, 10, 15 stories and up tall out of trees that are no bigger than 6 inches in diameter, or 20 centimeters in diameter for the metrics among us. So imagine that you can build skyscrapers out of wood from trees that are relatively small. It's quite inspiring, and there's another loop. There you have a kind of innovation ecosystem in a city that is making these connections to these faraway landscapes and producing something that transforms the way we really like. I mean, a mass timber building is a whole new way of living. I mean, you step into one of these buildings and you just feel like this whole different aura of the wood is just, it's somehow exuding calm. And this is a study thing. It's kind of this crazy, mind-blowing thing that it actually is proven to reduce your blood pressure and your heart rate when you step into a wood building.
All right, Dan, this is your cue to jump in with any wood discussion here before I take Scott over in his political advocacy here. So I don't know if you guys want to nerd out about wood for a minute here.
Well, I mean, Scott's pretty much laid down all the core principles that I would have used to advocate for the use of mass timber, in urban construction. I guess one question would be a little bit about supply chains, because I think one of the most ironic things that I discovered in my own research about mass timber construction is some of the leading countries where they've been willing to experiment with it don't really have much in the way of a timber industry. So I'm thinking of like Australia, where you're literally transporting manufactured CLT panels from Austria. That is not a typo, over 10,000 kilometers by sea, land, and, and rail, to build these structures in places like Brisbane and Melbourne. So, I mean, the crazy thing about that is that on balance, if you look at the scope of emissions and the LCA stages that are associated with it, it is still more sustainable in the sum total of carbon outputs than a concrete plant that's like two blocks away, which would be the default way to build these buildings. So that's quite interesting. I just wonder if there are aspects of the story of timber's net sustainability equation that still need to be completed. We talked about this a little bit when I was up there the other day, which was that, timber sort of does really, really well at the beginning of the life cycle because obviously it's a regenerative material. And then as you get toward the end of the life cycle, the proof points are not there because A, very few timber buildings, engineered timber buildings, have been constructed up to this point. And fortunately, they've had long lives, so there's no proof points to show that it's recyclable, which is an advantage that steel has because it's an established industry that uses a lot of recycling. So I guess, how do we overcome that so that, first of all, it's not a story of one material versus the other. It's often about hybrid, almost always about hybrid, especially if you're talking about high-risk buildings. But how do we sort of overcome that information gap so that that's just one objection point that I guess you can eliminate in the sales pitch for hybrid mass timber construction?
Oh my goodness! We're gonna geek out on this. I hope everybody's okay with that because, here at Pilot Projects, I guess we could say we're probably one of the few organizations that has an equal, let's say, interest and capacity in the, let's say, the boutique conservation tropical timber world, which is a completely different kind of system in a way than the mass timber world, which we are also very invested in. We just produced the Mass Timber Tipping Point report, which is a report basically talking to North America's leading architects and engineers about their struggles and successes with mass timber. Again, very much a North American context, that was its intention, but really digging into all the issues about why is it hard, what are the roadblocks, how does it work successfully, and dealing with, on the farther extreme, small communities, often, very remote in tropical contexts, indigenous communities and local communities that have lived more or less in kind of some level of isolation. Many of those now have iPhones and they're connected to the global culture and marketplace through digital technology, but they're still very living in extreme poverty and rural areas who are on the front lines of tropical forest outcomes. And I could say both the deforestation and the conservation. And so they are critical communities. And so we are engaging with that full spectrum. So when it comes to timber in a city, again, there's two extremes. One we call conservation timber. And I'll just paraphrase that as small scale, low volume, high impact wood from natural tropical forests that is sourced in a way that is beneficial to the long-term conservation of that forest. So that is, again, that's not a lot of wood. That's not something we're going to build a skyscraper out of. That's something we're going to make handrails and stair treads, kitchen countertops perhaps, outdoor infrastructure, low volume. Montreal's park benches, for example, are a an opportunity that was not quite seized on this matter, but they are made of tropical timber, not all of them, but many of them. Without that full supply chain transparency, they're FSC certified, so they've sort of tried to do the right thing. But we're trying to go way deeper with the cities and say, don't build anything out of tropical wood in your city unless you know exactly who produced that wood and what is their story. And not only just know about it, but tell everybody about it and actually have the person, the thousands of people that are going to sit on that bench over the next 5 years, engage with that story. Because isn't that super cool that you could be sitting on a bench in Montreal and know that this came from this particular part of Guatemala, and here's the community, and here's their mission, and we're supporting that mission. Okay, so that's the small-scale conservation forest story. And then let's come back to Austria shipping wood to Australia to build mid and high-rise buildings, which is another pretty cool story. And like the first thing we often think about in the low-carbon built environment world is distance. And I just want to say here, our position on that is distance is an almost irrelevant factor when it comes to the carbon footprint. There are other issues there for a few reasons. Now, I will say this. Distance by truck versus distance by rail versus distance by cargo ship are very different from each other. So you can't obviously just measure kilometers as the crow flies. You have to look at what's happening. And, you know, it starts to add up, especially truck of those systems is the worst offender. So, you know, 500 kilometers by truck, I wouldn't put the numbers, but it's probably like almost a tenfold difference in emissions compared to, say, a high efficiency cargo ship transport. We've run these numbers many times because when we're talking about bringing tropical wood to Paris or to Toronto for that matter, it immediately comes up, oh my goodness, why on earth would we take wood from you know, 2,000 kilometers, 4,000 kilometers away? And when we can get it from our backyard, that's a reasonable question too, right? I mean, there's urban timber. We're very big on urban timber, salvaging timber from trees from inside of cities. That's a phenomenal way to engage, especially to engage young people and small businesses in, you know, the sort of circular enterprises. Amazing. We are not competing with that. But what we would say is these communities in these tropical forests that you say you care about are desperate for your business. They have a product and it is sitting there in a yard, and that product is responsible for the conservation that they're actively doing at their own expense in these millions of hectares of forest. And you're saying we wouldn't buy that product. That's hypocrisy. If you aren't willing to look at that and say we would, now, okay, then let's put our carbon footprint of transport on that. And I can guarantee you that those products, when you look at the transport carbon footprint, is so small compared to the conservation value, it doesn't even, it's a rounding error compared to what you're doing if you can support an active conservation enterprise in one of these forests. So that's a pretty cool thing, and it's pretty sexy for designers and stuff to be able to say, not only we're making amazing things out of wood, which we love as designers, but we're going to bring a narrative of forest management, of young people, of the next generation of forest stewards right into the city streets of Montreal, right on. I took a picture on of the Leonard Cohen mural here in Montreal. I'm trying to remember which street it was on, but it was basically, it's a perfect shot. It's a Montreal park bench, and there's the kind of this perfect urban scene. It's like, this is the kind of cultural connection we want to make globally.
All right, we're running low on time, so I'm going to interrupt the nerd outery here, and I want to go back to the political advocacy side, because Scott, I've been obviously noticing for years now that Cities for Forests is very active at COP events, and let's tie us back to Montreal for a second. Montreal, among its other accomplishments, is known for the Montreal Protocol of 1987, which was the UN agreement to ban chlorofluorocarbons that repaired the ozone layer. More recently, COP15 on the biodiversity side was a landmark agreement to protect global biodiversity. So that's an interesting jumping off point for the fact that, yeah, Cities for Forests, you've been very active in Glasgow, in Dubai, in Baku, and now coming up Belém, Brazil for COP30 on the broader carbon emission side. Scott, I'm curious, what do you get out of such events? I'm like, you know, because there's, I read about it from far, and there's, I mean, there was tens of thousands of people. It's like Davos or the Super Bowl combined on a climate side. Yeah. And everyone's jostling for attention. All the media brands have their houses. Like, it's, you know, it's one of those huge mega events. And so I'm curious, like, yeah, who do you meet there? How do you advance your mission there? And also, you know, you design activation. So I'm curious, like, how you bring the design piece in and what you're planning for Brazil this year.
Well, to keep it short, the design for activation is the key piece for us, and that's where I think our skill set really aligns with our mission. We're good at designing cool stuff that brings people together. We believe in events as a tool. So for COP15 here in Montreal, we brought in a local circus troupe. Montreal is known for its circus ecosystem.
Come for our circus festival in the summers, listeners. Come for our circus festival. Because, you know, home of Cirque du Soleil, we have more like circus performers per capita than any other city in North America, too.
Yeah, so we had a co-design with a circus troupe to do some biodiversity-themed performance. But we brought folks into this carnival. We created a little carnival inside this beautiful historic space in downtown Montreal. And we just basically had a party and brought people that were involved in the COP into... participate. We actually built all the infrastructure for this event out of reclaimed ash trees that were killed by the ash borer. Anyway, that's a little microcosm. We're big believers in network effects and how bringing people together in the right way, not just kind of slamming them into a room, although that often generates some pretty cool stuff, but just give it a little, take that serendipity, Greg, that you're very familiar with and have written about, and just cook it up a bit. Like, how can you cook that serendipity and get even a little bit more out of it? So at the COPs, that's what we did in Glasgow. We created a whole space. We created a partner forest boardwalk with timber from a community in Guatemala. They actually were there at the COPs. They were there like proudly on this boardwalk. We invited people to come and walk it. That wood all got used for permanent planters in the city of Glasgow, so it was sort of showing that circularity piece, that this wood can be around for decades when it's used well. And we created a coffee truck with like 15 different products, food products, coffees, chocolates, vanillas, all these products from forest positive sources. So it was this little buffet of wonderful treats and of course coffee at the center point. And then we had a space to bring people together. This was a side event in Glasgow. At the same time in Glasgow, Cities for Forest held a kind of political convening in the Blue Zone on a call to action. So we took our network of cities. At that time, I think we were about 60 cities. We got 45 of them to sign into this call to action, which was a call to action in the COP context to national governments. So it was kind of like, here we are as these 45 cities, we are calling out to our national governments and the private sector, but particularly the national governments, to take more action on these top items. And we kind of itemized some of the actions that national governments could take to support this. So that was an example of a sort of political piece within the COP context. In Dubai, my focus there, although, I mean, there's always a tremendous amount going on, was this idea of systemic collaboration. So I guess you could say on the downside of this wealth of organizations and projects and programs, there tends to be in this world a duplication of efforts, to put it nicely, a little bit of competition sometimes. I created a collaboration spectrum for this conversation, which was on one side you had like full systemic collaboration, everyone's on the same team, we're all pulling together. At the far end, other end of the spectrum, you have all-out war with each other, which is basically, I succeed if you fail. And then you have like 10 different sort of, it's like, in the middle is, I don't quite know that you exist, but I'm not going to try to kill you. And then you have like, oh, I acknowledge that they exist. And then, but so we want to really move towards that team of teams approach, where if we have a common mission, and let's say our common mission is within one of these spaces of, say, the bio-based built environment. That's the way we sort of bounded it for COP28 in Dubai. It's like, we ought to know who each other are, right? We ought to acknowledge the presence of our peers within that, look at their respective capabilities, think about this as a system, which means not everyone's good at the same thing, and we have to think about designing the system for how we work together. And if sports is the best way to do this quickly, it's like a basketball team, right? If you have two teams, one is all-star players, but they have never played together before, and you put them on a court, and you have a decent team, not all-star, who have worked together and crafted a strategy, that less than all-star team is going to beat the other team. By the way, that was proven by the Americans, who took it for granted that they could take a bunch of NBA players and stick them on the court. And for several years, they got beat by, who knew, Spain, better than the United States at basketball, Greece. And so they had to regroup and rethink a strategic approach. We are not doing that in this world. And COP, unfortunately, is an example of probably, you could say, the full spectrum of collaboration. Right? Of course, there's some amazing collaboration going on. That is one of the objectives of COP, is to pull together. But we've got to do better. And I think within this world of city leadership and discourse, we've got to use what we can to build trust, to build awareness, and to co-create that system. So we're going to be doing that at COP30 we've got a proposal that hasn't been fully funded yet to pull all this together. This is going to be, wait for it, a mass timber, conservation timber pavilion that is going to be floating on the Amazon River system, docked in Belém. Belém is a harbor city, and so there's a port that wraps all the way around the city. There's a very limited amount of space for anything because of the demand on the city, with, I think, is it 30,000 visitors they're expecting at this point? There's not going to be enough beds, there's not going to be enough spaces. So our proposal is to build this floating pavilion and have it be a hub for the discourse on bio-based materials, on timber construction. So it's both a Amazonian example of how wood can be used for urban construction, also how the signal can be directed back to the community producers for conservation, and a place to get people together and have these events. So we're trying to wrap it all up in this COP30 work that we're doing.
That is astonishing. I am so excited to hear about this boat. And to call it a boat is not quite, that's really an understatement, this pavilion that really sort of communicates the potential kind of connects some of the loose threads that I think everyone's sort of generally aware of. You know, like it's a bad thing to deforest, you know, the tropical forests in the Amazon, but it might be a good thing to cultivate timber producing forests in the global north. And those are not oppositional goals. They actually serve the same goal, you know. So I think anything you can do to communicate that and to make cities and people who work on behalf of cities aware of it, you know, would have to be a good thing. I mean, if I were going to the conference, I would be definitely angling for trying to get a spot on that pavilion.
We'll try to save you a hammock, Dan, because our intention is to have some hammocks for. There's going to be so much overflow of people looking for places to stay. We're hoping to harness that energy and say, like, yes, we're going to have a mix of government dignitaries and private sector leaders and investors and activists hanging out on the top floor where we have our receptions and events and conferences on the lower floors. But I want to clarify something. It's the use of timber from the source. The Amazon will be the source for this timber. This is probably the most counterintuitive piece, when it's still so easy to think that cutting a tree down in a tropical forest is a terrible thing to do. But when it is part of a livelihood scenario, that is what is the very thing that allows the community to keep that forest standing, that's the critical piece. Because the alternative, just to make it clear for everybody, the alternative, the driver of deforestation, is economic demand for clearing the land for alternative uses, right? I need cow pasture or soybeans or whatever, and I can make more money with soybeans than keeping a forest. It's that simple. That's the deforestation driver. It is, I need to support my community, my family, or I own it and I want to maximize my investment, cut it down and turn it into something else. What we're saying is a judicial extraction of timber can generate just enough money that can allow that forest to maintain all of its ecological benefits, all of its benefits in carbon and biodiversity, and a long-term a community relationship. Isn't that amazing? So like, let's buy that wood and let's show people that it can be that beneficial, and let's let cities be one of the activators and embracers. By the way, Paris is finally taking this on after many years of thinking about it, and they're bringing this message. They're creating, with our help, Cities for Forests, and the city of Paris has co-created a declaration on forests and cities that will come to COP, so wrapping it all up, hopefully be presented on our pavilion on the Amazon, but it will come regardless. The mayor of Paris, Mayor Hidalgo, is behind this 100%. We will be in Vietnam in a few weeks with the Alliance of Francophone Mayors, co-presenting this for all the French-speaking cities that will then expand to the global cities that will then come to COP. It will be in Paris at the COP 21 Paris Agreement 10-year anniversary in June. And so this is a kind of a sign that cities are seeing that opportunity to use their global influence in this way.
That's amazing. And just as we see French President Macron trying to lead the global north, lead the west right now, we have Mayor Hidalgo really leading the global alliance of cities. Well, I hope Mayor Plante will be there too, and in Vietnam,
so.
and signing that as well. But yeah, amazing stuff. And my only thing for listeners, if you want your own little piece of the Amazon, amazing that notion of we have to use the rainforest as it is to save it. My personal version of that one is when I was in Sao Paulo years ago, the Brazilian chef Alex Atala, who ran one of the highest end restaurants in the city, Dom, but his real passion was finding products in the rainforest and sustainably using them. And he is the one who introduced the idea of hearts of palm pasta, which you can now get at Trader Joe's. I have a couple boxes. So hopefully the TJ supply chain is treating that well as well. Well, Scott, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for joining us on Frozen for our special Montreal-themed episode. Let's not wait so long, either of you, to do another episode like this in a couple of years. Yes, Scott.
Look us up. Pilotprojects.org is our website, and all of our projects, including the Habitat Bio Pavilion for COP and our mass timber work, all of it's on our, it's pilot-projects.org. Love to have any of the listeners reach out to us, whether you're in Montreal or anywhere in the world. And we've got lots of opportunities for collaboration, systemic collaboration. So this is a call to cities, to folks in the bio-based economy world. Come to us. Let's work together.
You heard it. Well, all right, everyone. We'll see you there. And thanks so much for joining us on this episode of Unfrozen. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys. Amazing.